Judiciary Committee come to order. It is 1:32 on the afternoon of February 2nd, 2011. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator McGuire is here, Senator Pascavan, Senator Wilikowski, myself, Senator French. Senator Coghill has a scheduling conflict and will not be here right away. We have three bills in the committee right now, SB 31, counting of write-in votes, SB 33, disposition of service members remains, and SB 58, increasing the number of Superior Court judges. My intention is to move the first two I mentioned and hear and hold the last one. And so with that, why don't we turn our attention to SB 31. We took public testimony at the last hearing, but we didn't close public testimony, so let me just make sure we don't have anyone online or in the room who wants to give us their view of SB 31 and act relating to the counting of write-in votes. There's no one online, no one in the room. Excellent. We'll close public testimony. We did receive, and you all should have, a memo from Altheus Bullard, just going over in some detail the questions that came up during the last hearing about misspellings of the first question is, why are abbreviations included along with the spellings? Gives an excellent answer to that question. Talked about the function of the committee's substitute, and finally, the troublesome phrase on page 3, he describes why the "as" appears on the right-hand declaration of candidacy language was retained in the committee bill, and gave a good explanation of that as well. Oh, finally, in the last page, he answered the trivia question, which I think pretty well stumped the panel of experts we had last time, which was, may a writing candidate running for office of governor run without an accompanying writing candidate for the office of lieutenant governor? Altheus Bullard says, no, they must run together. Run together. He cites AS 1525-105B. It says that the candidate must file a joint letter of intent together with the candidate for lieutenant governor. Both candidates must be of the same political party or group. Maybe some future election will challenge that statute, and we'll get a long, drawn-out campaign over that issue. But for the time being, it's going to sit on the statutes unmolested. So is there anything else we need to discuss with respect to this bill from the committee? Solicit a motion. Senator Wilikowski.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that the committee move out CS for Senate Bill 31, /E as an echo, to the next committee of referral, along with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Hearing seeing none, the bill is moved. Let's take a short at ease to sign the sheet. We're back on the record, the Judiciary Committee, and next up is Senate Bill number 33 by Senator Wilikowski and others who've signed on, an act relating to the disposition of remains of a member of the armed forces if the member dies while in duty status. We had a hearing on the bill during our last meeting, took public testimony, had a lot of support. I don't think I asked on the record, and I'll ask Senator Wilikowski, if you heard from anyone who does not support this bill or who opposes it.
Mr. Chairman, I have not heard from anyone. My staffer, Michael, is shaking. He said that he has not heard from anyone in opposition to this bill either. We've had nothing but support.
It's not unsurprising, but I just thought I'd ask that while we had the bill in our possession. Any other questions for the bill sponsor regarding the bill? If not, then I would solicit a motion on it as well. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this backslash D that we're on?
D, Delta is what I have.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'd move that the committee move CS for Senate Bill number 33 backslash D out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the bill's moved. Again, another short at ease. Record in the Judiciary Committee, and we are now ready to turn to SB 58, dealing with the number of Superior Court judges. I see Mr. Wolliver is here. Welcome, Mr. Wolliver. Your first appearance before the committee this year, but certainly well known to us. Welcome back. Nice to see you. And as you know, you should put yourself on the record and tell us about what you have in mind here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Wolliver. I'm the administrative attorney for the Alaska court system. It is my first time back. The last time I was before you, I think last year I was talking about the exact same issue, and that's adding Superior Court judges in Anchorage. Last year, this committee passed out a bill, and the Senate passed it over to the House, added one new Superior Court judge to the civil bench in Anchorage. That bill ended up not making it out in the last days of the session, so I'm back again this year. This year, though, we're asking for two new Superior Court judges in Anchorage. And that just reflects the fact that since last year, the caseload in Anchorage has increased by the equivalent of one more judge. Anchorage is the busiest Superior Court in the state by quite a ways, but in terms of cases filed per judge, but that's kind of only part of the reason for the request. Some court is necessarily going to be the busiest court. That isn't necessarily a reason to add more judges. And it's the work associated with two types of cases in particular that kind of generate this request. The first type of case are the child need of aid cases. And I talked about this last year. Child need of aid cases over the last several years, or the last couple of years in particular, the Superior Court in Anchorage has increased the amount of time Superior Court judges spend on those cases. In the past, a lot more of the work was done by the standing masters in Anchorage. Those are basically assistants to the Superior Court judges. They take a lot of the workload away from the Superior Court judges and allow the Superior Court judges to do things only a Superior Court judge can do. But in the child need of aid cases, it creates problems by doing that. And a number of years ago, the master would handle a child need of aid case until it was contested. Then it would be transferred over to whichever Superior Court judge was available to hear it, and then it would go back to the standing master once the contested issue was resolved. That wasn't a very good system. They were before numerous judges over the course of their case, and that wasn't very successful. It was changed a little bit a few years ago so that the standing master would handle the case, but when there was a contested issue, it would be sent to one particular Superior Court judge, so one judge would have that case each time. But even still, you were bouncing back and forth between the master and the Superior Court judge depending on whether your issue was contested. Our new model, which we think is a much better model, it starts off the same. The standing master takes the case initially, but as soon as an issue is contested, the file moves permanently to one particular Superior Court judge, and that judge then has that case for the life of the case. This is a better model, we think, in a number of ways. The litigants like it better. The attorneys like it better. They're before one judge. And importantly, too, social workers know, and the attorneys who work with these families know, the better you get to know the family, the better you can serve that family. They trust you more. They will open up more. The judge is the same. The judge gets to know these families over the time they're with the court, and as you know, some of these families come back more than once in child need of aid cases. They always have the same Superior Court judge. It creates a better dynamic. We think it's a little more humane way to treat the family, and the judge gets to know the family gets to know the judge, and it works better. But it does mean that a lot of the work that used to be done by a standing master is now done by a sitting Superior Court judge. So even though our China caseload hasn't increased, the amount of time judges are spending on those cases has increased. And there's another important change that we've made in our China practice that influences how much time Superior Court judges spend on these cases. Judges are starting to have status hearings, which is one of these cases where a therapeutic court model is now kind of bleeding into other types of other case types. As you know, in the therapeutic court, you come back before the court routinely, over and over and over. You know, especially initially, you come back in 2 weeks, and then you come back in another 2 weeks, and then you come back in 4 weeks after that if you're doing well. If you're not doing well, you start coming back every 2 weeks again. Well, they're trying a similar thing with the child need of aid cases. As you know, when a family comes into the child need of aid system, they will have a variety of things they need to do to get their children back. And sometimes the list of things they need to do is long. They may need to get into alcohol treatment, substance abuse treatment, family, parenting classes, find safe and sober housing. They may need to ditch the boyfriend that's the abuser that's causing the trouble in the house. They may need to find employment. And some of these, they have to do them all just for one family. The old practice, the judge gives them a list of things, that these are what you need to do, and you'll have a hearing in X number of months to see how well you've done. Now, they'll be working with the Office of Children's Services throughout this time, but they won't see the judge again. Well, the therapeutic court model has just taught the whole judiciary that if you can bring people back more regularly with smaller goals each time, say, okay, I want to see you in 2 weeks, but here's what I want you to do within the first 2 weeks. You know, I want you to do whichever is the most important on that list, and then we'll go from there. And by coming back before the court a lot more often, the families are a lot, well, our plan is, our hope is, the families will be more successful in meeting their responsibilities to get their kids back. Now, though the federal government has some timelines for child need of aid cases, and if they don't make enough progress within a certain amount of time, the state's required to proceed with termination of their parental rights. But this timeline shouldn't be a race to termination. The statutes, you've made it clear, and the courts have made it clear, the number one goal of the China statutes is family reunification. That isn't always possible, and it isn't always advisable, but that's always where you start. And we think this model is a better way to get there. It makes the plans that they have to go through more manageable, and we're hoping that we're more successful in getting families back together. But it also means more hearings and more judicial time. The other type of case that's significantly influencing the Superior Court workload are domestic relations cases with unrepresented litigants. And this is an area where we, unlike the China, that the number of cases hasn't gone up a lot, domestic relations cases are going up in Anchorage. We know now from our data that we see a steady increase in the number of unrepresented litigants in court. In domestic relations cases, well over 50% of the time, at least one party doesn't have an attorney. In about 38% of the time, neither party has an attorney. And there are a number of reasons why having no lawyers in a divorce case means more work for the judge. The litigants frequently don't focus on the legal issues the judge actually has to resolve. It's kind of like sometimes when you get public testimony in your hearings, you have people who they understand the bill, they know what they're doing, and other times people come in, they haven't read the bill, they don't quite know what the subject is, but they have something they want to talk about. It may or may not be what you have before you. Well, it's the same with judges and sometimes with unrepresented litigants. However, unrepresented litigants have every right to be in court just as those who have attorneys. And our court in particular has made an effort to make the court as accessible to Alaskans as possible, even those without lawyers. Some states have taken the other approach because pro se litigants, unrepresented litigants, are showing up across the country in much, much greater numbers. Some courts have tried to avoid the problems we're having by simply making it next to impossible to get to court without a lawyer. Well, our court has taken the opposite approach, that everybody has a right to get to court, especially in cases where the only way your issue can be resolved is by going to court. You can't get divorced without a court. So we see a lot more of these people, and part of it is because we've made it so easy. We have a family law self-help center that's terrifically successful, that helps people through the process. They've developed dozens and dozens and dozens of forms with detailed instructions about every phase of the process. It makes it easier to appear in court without a lawyer. But it means Superior Court judges now have an awful lot of domestic relations cases with people who generally don't really know what they're doing. But again, this is the court thinks this is part of our responsibility. It takes more time to handle unrepresented litigants. But the only alternative really is making it very difficult for them to appear. But that isn't the only way to address a workload is with additional lawyers. Particularly when it comes to domestic relations cases, there are a number of things the court's doing. We've got a pro se settlement project that just got started by Judge Ioannidis, who's just retired, but she's going to stay on as a pro tem and help run this program, where they try to settle these cases beforehand. We're looking for some federal mediation money to handle the high conflict custody cases where the parents fight over absolutely everything and come to court for the smallest of things, try to get those mediated. We've hired an attorney to help figure out child support awards. Pro se litigants are notoriously poor at figuring those out, and the judges are doing it themselves. So we've hired some staff to help with that relatively ministerial project, but it's still something that has to be done and has to be right. So we aren't just asking for more judges. We're trying some of these other things as well. But even with these additional practices, such as the settlements and things like that, and with the additional staff, there's still an awful lot of things that only a Superior Court judge can do. And it's those things that right now I've got a workload in Anchorage that's just unsustainable. So that's my testimony. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Woolover. Questions from Mr. Woolover? Senator Pascoe.
On the first component of it, on the China cases, are you saying that the Superior Court judge is the judge then for even multiple children, even years apart?
Through the chair, Senator Pascoe, yes. I think those families keep coming back under the same case numbers, and as long as that judge is still there, that judge will hear those cases.
I was just thinking, you know, if there was a gap of 2 years and the case comes back, you know, the state says we have a child in need of aid, is there a procedure if the family wanted to disqualify the judge, for example? You know, that's a pretty standard,
right,
you know, option. And how does that trigger if they, you know, in other words, I don't know how that works. I've never done China cases, but, you know, the peremptory disqualification is always an issue. So
through the chair, Senator Pascoe, I would have to check to see if you come back again with another case. I think it's the same case number, but whether or not you have, you know, you restart the peremptory challenge clock, I'm not sure about that. But I think if you can, I guess that would change it in some cases. But generally, the case will at least initially be assigned to the same judge. And you're right, some families are back a lot.
Mm-hmm. And I agree with the concept, if I may.
Yeah, please.
I agree with the concept that the judge is better if they're familiar with the family, but then I'm just trying to balance those issues of peremptory challenges and how that fits in. If it's a gap of 2 or 3 years, a different kid, you know, I just kind of think that through a little bit.
I'll find out for you.
I guess it would depend on whether the cases are open by family name or by child name. But we'll see. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Woolover. I'm disappointed that we didn't get the legislation all the way through the finish line last year, because your arguments were compelling then and as compelling as they are today, maybe more so now just because more time has passed. And certainly we feel it, and those of us here on the committee are from the legal community, and so we hear it from our friends that are working in the system, and it's certainly overtaxed, overcrowded, and there has to be some relief. My question to you is about the gender balance on the court, and certainly there have been articles written and a lot of media focus on it, and I don't expect you to be an expert in it, but I do want to bring it up on the record. And I'd like to know to what end there have been discussions about that gender balance, and what in particular the court system is doing to look at how other states have attracted or recruited more women to consider applying for. Obviously, we have the Judicial Council and a unique system, a system that works very well here in our state. We don't elect judges, a system that wherein people have to apply. Their peers then go through a process of analyzing and voting on them in a variety of categories. And then those names are ultimately submitted to the head of our state, whoever that person is, he or she at the time. There are a variety of reasons that have been cited, most notably that very few women are putting their names forward. Mm-hmm. So there are fewer women who end up in the applicant pool for Superior Court positions. But it is disappointing to me, looking at the figures in our state, knowing that we're getting closer and closer, particularly in the South Central area, to more of a 50-50 split between men and women. I would like to see more women on the bench. We're getting closer here in our third branch of government, in the legislative branch, because I do think that women bring a unique perspective to the bench. And I would just like to hear what discussions have been held about recruiting and retaining the women that are there in the court.
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, I don't know, but I can find out. As you know, Justice Fabe is either current or past chair of the Council of Women Judges for the United States, and she does a lot of work with reintegrating a lot of goes out to Highland Mountain and works with the women prisoners. I mean, women's issues are high on her list, and I'll find out what she or the rest of the court is doing in terms of, you know, what they can do in this area, and I'll get back to you.
Excellent.
Please.
And thank you. And through the chair, thank you very much. And just one last point on that. Some creative ideas that she and Justice Morgan were looking at last year, they came down here to visit the daycare that we started over here. Representative Nelson and Nelson Kapsner and I and some other lawmakers about 8 years ago put together a task force to start looking at what we could do to really attract more women to run for office here and improve the numbers in the legislative branch. And one of the things that kept coming up over and over and over again from NCSL and National Conference of State Lawmakers and Council of State Governments documents was that having on-site or close proximity access to daycare for your children was important. Justice Fabe and Justice Morgan, who had just been appointed to the bench, both came over and took a tour of the daycare and were really interested in how that could make a difference in recruiting and retaining judges in all three, the district, superior, and Supreme Court levels, as well as staff. And it was something that they pointed out to me that I didn't realize, that over 70% of the court staff are women, young women in their baby-making years. And one of the tensions that they face is that they get these young women really trained up, and they're the vital, you know, link for the court system, and they don't want to let them go, but child care is often a really difficult part of that. So that's just one thing I throw out that I know they've been exploring. I'm sure there are others. We'd like to be a partner in that process as well, and so please come forward if you can back to this committee with whatever those ideas are. We'd like to see more women on the bench.
Okay, thank you. I will do that.
And Senator McGuire, thank you so much for both of those remarks. I fear that this panel may have overlooked them both in our questioning of this topic. So I appreciate you bringing them forward, because they're both well aimed and certainly pertinent. Specifically, I think it bears mentioning that on the first point, you know, more women judges on the bench. I think it was reported that of the 24 sitting Anchorage Superior Court judges, there is one female, Sharon Gleason, and that's remarkable. And I certainly, you know, don't direct that at you, Mr. Wolver. I just make that as a comment. I would be interested, and I'll probably ask Ledge Research to look at, you know, sort of what's happened over the last 10 or 12 appointments that we've sort of slid so badly to such an imbalance. There are extremely talented female attorneys practicing in Anchorage and statewide. I'm sure they've been applying. I don't know if they've not been given to the Judicial Council, and we'll have a new member to the Judicial Council in front of us for a conversation a little bit later in this year, or they're just not getting picked by the governor. It's interesting. One question I have, and that is just I'll let you give me what your view is. Last year you asked for one judge. We didn't get there. This year you're back for two judges. I hope you get there. Is this going to be are we going to be adding a judge every year now on the Anchorage bench? Is that the sort of projected growth of the cases there?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think so. It's the last time we added judges in Anchorage was in 2006. We haven't had a record of that. And felony caseloads continue to go up a lot in Anchorage. So far, the felony judges are staying on top of it, in part because of some very successful reforms that occurred in the way felonies are handled there. If we do come back for a judge in the next couple of years, it's likely to be for the criminal bench. But I don't anticipate coming back every year for new judges.
Are all the Superior Court judges we have in Anchorage operating out of the Nesbitt Courthouse or not?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not actually sure because we're in the middle of remodeling, and I think the goal is to move the district court over to the Boney Building. I'm not sure. I think the standing master may still be some of our masters may still be in the Boney Building. I can find out, but I'm not sure what the. I know they're in transition. I don't know if we currently have a Superior Court judge over in the Boney or not, but I think they are all in the Nesbitt.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Pascoe.
Sure. In, you know, kind of the following up on the distinction between misdemeanors and felonies and commenting upon the increase in felony prosecutions that the Superior Court has to handle, has there been any analysis of having the family law matters like divorce without children or divorce mm-hmm. with assets under $100,000 handled by district court judges, or just the family law matters handled by district court judges completely, and, you know, leaving mm-hmm. the Superior Court judges to handle the more significant civil issues and the felony criminal issues?
Through the chair, Senator Pascavan, not that I'm aware of, but the family law matters are the bulk of what the Superior Court judges do. There has been discussion occasionally to peel off the child need of aid cases to just a handful of judges. The resistance has been that would leave the other Superior Court judges doing basically nothing but family law. Mm-hmm. And in the world of Superior Court judges, those are not the favorite cases. Nobody wants to be stuck with a caseload that is just family law cases. I always thought China cases would be the worst, but the judges would rather do China cases than a never-ending stream of family law cases. So I don't see a current plan to redivide up the work, either between the district and Superior Court or within the Superior Court itself.
Please.
It just generally, you know, we have the highest paying and I think the smartest judges at the Superior Court level, mm-hmm. and whether, you know, the inherent question is should they be dividing knives, forks, mm-hmm. and spoons?
Well, through the chair, Senator Pascoe, that's true. And, you know, it's also a huge chunk of our Supreme Court caseload are dividing knives, forks, and spoons because everybody has the right to appeal, and many of them do, and it's a big chunk of the Supreme Court's caseload, too.
Hence my reason to have them go to district court because then they have a mandatory right of appeal to Superior Court. Right. They would not have a appeal as a matter of right to the Supreme Court. And I think that you're right on the appeal as a matter of right to the Supreme Court. So then we got the highest and the highest paid, brightest people dividing up knives, forks, and spoons, and one wonders the validity of the system.
Senator Wilikowski.
I would agree. I know other states have different have, there are some states that just have family court divisions. I know that because I clerked when I was in law school for a short time for a family court judge. And I think there probably is some merit to at least exploring that, putting all those cases in, under the jurisdiction of the district court or a family law division or something. I don't know if it's been explored. I think it is worth exploring, though, for sure.
Through the chair, I'll ask to see if Senator Wilkowski whether that's something the court has considered in the past, and maybe they have, and maybe they haven't thought of that.
And great set of questions, and obviously the issue has been raised. I clerked in the Superior Court before I went to the DA's office, and my judge was a civil court judge, and it was striking the difference in complexity between a typical sort of civil dispute involving. Perhaps millions of dollars, or even you know, several hundred thousand dollars, in a family law case. Yeah. The family law cases are gut wrenching. They're emotional. They're time intensive. But the legal issues weren't particularly complex. They just required a lot of management. Mm-hmm. Yeah, whereas the civil cases frequently turned on highly technical questions of law that you want to the smartest person you can get. Making a decision. So clearly the committee is interested in whether we need to continue adding judges to handle family law cases. Other questions for Mr. Wolliver? Don't hear or see any. Let's see if we've got anybody who wants to testify on Senate Bill 58 else in the room. Don't hear or see anybody. Anybody online? We do have for the committee's information Quinlan Steiner and Rachel Levitt. Quinlan, of course, is from the Public Defender Agency, and Ms. Levitt is from the Office of Public Advocacy to answer questions. I guess I'll get on the record. I think this has been cleared up, but I'll get on the record. You may have noticed that you've got fiscal notes from the probation office, from, the Public Defender Agency, and so forth, that raised a question in my office regarding why those agencies were submitting fiscal notes when we're adding civil court judges. Did we get a good answer to that? Maybe Mr. Steiner, can you tell me what was in your thinking with respect to the fiscal note?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is Quinlan Steiner. I'm the director of the Alaska Public Defender Agency. We put in a fiscal note because our attorneys, we have a civil division that handles China matters, and the addition of two judges scheduling China matters would require us to place more attorneys before those judges and would accelerate our workload based upon the cases that we have, though that caseload isn't increasing. It would accelerate our caseload and require more work. We wouldn't be able to meet the demand of the workload without the resources.
Okay, that makes sense. And Ms. Levitt, I take it your answer is something along the same lines. You've got a civil division there at OPA.
Yes, for the record, this is Rachel Levitt from the Office of Public Advocacy. That is correct. We provide parental representation in China cases when the Public Defender Agency has a conflict of interest, and we'd be in the same position that Mr. Steiner's agency is in.
Thank you. Those were my questions. Other questions for either Mr. Steiner or Ms. Levitt? Senator Pascrane has a question.
Just along the lines of the fiscal note, you know, I think it's interesting to see that when after the build out of the judges, that they're looking at $930,000 for two Superior Court judge seats. So that's, $475,000 essentially per judge per year. And, that's with all that's the cost. And so when one looks at that's going to, in my mind, to areas that if it's a divorce with no kids or divorce with no assets, mm-hmm. I think we potentially have better use for the Superior Court.
Comment?
I heard the comment through the chair. Yes, I get your point, and I will. I'll take this issue to the court and see about the idea of other ways to handle family law matters.
Thank you. Any other anyone else online who wants to testify about SB 58? Don't hear or see anybody. I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. We will hold the bill over. I think the committee is interested in puzzling over this for some time, maybe thinking about innovations. Senator Wilkowski.
Good. We have an obligation. If we have laws in place and families with children or domestic violence issues arise and we're forcing people to go through the court system, we have an obligation to process those cases in a timely manner, and it appears that we're probably not doing that right now. So I'd be interested if you could get back to us before we move the bill out in the next few weeks, Mr. Chair, if that's possible, and see if there are other alternatives. You know, we set up the drug court, the therapeutic courts. I think that's been extremely effective. I wonder if there are other alternative solutions. I'm completely supportive of providing the resources we need to process these cases. I'm just wondering if there's a more efficient or more effective way to do it.
Good comment. Senator McGuire.
Thank you. And on that point, I also think it's an opportunity for families because, and I'm going back to my time at Willamette, in Oregon, as you know, they have a family court system as well, and they controversially require mediation as a step prior to being able to get a divorce, and some people disagree about that fact. We're not here to discuss that policy per se, but they have a very, very noteworthy family law court that has been built up there. And the benefit to the families ends up being of great value because the judges that are in that unit end up getting highly trained. They become experts in the best practices of family law, and it's complex. And I think one of the other things that happens is that as Senator Pascavan references and Senator French, these complex cases, you're juggling between the complex cases and the complex emotional case of a family law case. You've got children and families at stake their whole lives. Mm-hmm. And it's hard because you may not have dealt with one, for whatever the reason is, for several months. You may not know what's happening out there in terms of trends or even with respect to state law. Which brings me to another point. I had the pleasure of delving into some of these laws back when I was chair of the Judiciary Committee in the House side in the area of custody awards. We changed it to a presumption in the area of domestic violence, and it's being applied, and it was recently referenced in a Supreme Court opinion, and I'm honored by that. But what we had is a series of Superior Court judges that were not applying that rebuttable presumption exactly the way that it was laid out. And I don't fault them for that. What I think is happening is, once again, the caseload is so big. And the time to really focus in on the laws and sort of the training that goes into being a family law judge is just not there. And so I think that there's a whole lot of opportunity to think about this. There are people, much like therapeutic courts, when you think of Judge Wanamaker, Stephanie Joannides, Stephanie Rhodes, whose brother suffered from mental illness, who really have a passion for these things. There may be individuals within our community that, rather than looking at this as a burden and saying, oh my God, you know, this another stack of family law cases, they say, what an opportunity to try and apply the best practices in the United States to my courtroom and try and lead these families forward out of the darkness and into light. And so I really hope that what we've given you today encourages dialogue. There's an opportunity to think about ways of doing things differently. I think that the concept of bumping is a big practice in Superior Court. I'm going through it myself, and I can tell you that there are judges that are known for being more sort of, I guess you'd say, in touch with family law practices than not, and things like that. And I think that families in Alaska would really benefit from having some judges that are in touch with family law itself and how to really help families move forward.
You know, it's just, I think we're wrapping up, but I'll just close with saying that I think Mr. Wolver is right. Judges in general don't pine for these cases. They, you know, they typically are looking for something more complex. But if during the judicial selection process you were recruiting for a family law judge, you would sort of by definition be looking at people who had sort of stepped forward to volunteer who would have sort of less reason to complain or to sort of shirk. I'm not saying any of them do, but I'm just saying that, you know, in the assignment of cases, you know, you sign up to be a family law judge. This is this is the job you wanted. You'd be looking probably at the best family law practitioners, folks who decided to either have an aptitude for it or a liking for it. So, yeah, I think it's an idea we're going to be talking about. Senator Pascal.
You know, I know in my discussion with people that have considered applying for judgeships or those that have been at the master's level, they can divide up children, so to speak. They can divide up, you know, and when it comes to divorce, and they can do that very easily. Put someone in jail, they just can't go there as a human being. You know, they have a problem for that. And so I think there's a mindset for the person that can go and be a judge at the district court or superior court level that has the capacity to put someone in jail potentially for a long, long time. And then there's a mindset of persons that when it comes to family law, they very much, would enjoy that. And I think I believe that there's not as much hesitancy to getting the people in family law that one might initially perceive.
Excellent. Thanks. A robust and invigorating discussion. I appreciate the input of the members. Thank you, Mr. Wolver, for being here. We'll hold the bill over. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you.